as a Chinese medicine practitioner, we're always concerned about the why, and the why always has to be addressed. So for the headache, we would not just treat the symptom, because I mean, killing the pain has to happen. We also try and figure, well, why did you get this headache? What's the underlying cause? Was this something to do with your digestive system or hormones or the weather or a muscle strain or stress? Or and then we want to address that too. Because from our point of view, one cause, one imbalance can lead to a lot of problems. So that imbalance that's maybe causing the headache now might cause something else later.
Hi, everyone. My name is Anisha, and I'm your host for the Wellness Plus podcast. In today's episode, I would love to welcome to the show Dr. Jack Schaefer. With a lifelong devotion to Taoism, martial arts, and Chinese medicine, Jack's expertise as a board-certified acupuncturist and herbalist illuminates a holistic approach to health and wellness. Through Jack's insights, we'll gain a deeper understanding of the transformative power of Taoist principles and the profound healing potential of Chinese medicine. Hi, Jack. Thank you so much for coming on.
Hey, thanks for having me, Anisha. I'm really excited to be here.
Yeah, I'm so excited. So can you start by telling us the fundamentals of Taoism and how it led you to your journey?
I would say that there are a lot of aspects to what Taoism is and ways to live it. I think that for me, through my entire life, from my teenage years up until this point, you know, I've been interested in different aspects of it. And, you know, you could say different parts of it have kind of called to me. So, you know, Taoism is really, I mean, it's the native religion of China. But through the, you know, 2000 plus years that it's been growing and changing and whatnot, you know, it too, it's a living tradition. So the things that make Taoism tick, I guess, its point of view in the universe has also changed. And what that leads to as a practitioner then are lots of opportunities. Because, you know, Taoism is very focused on, you know, health and longevity is something we do. But it's not the only focus. Taoism is very focused on, you know, stopping reincarnation for us as well as all sentient beings, much like Buddhism. And so that's also a really interesting topic. And, you know, maybe when you're younger, you don't care as much about that. But as you get older, you start to really think about your mortality and next lives, and you start to see the suffering around the world. And that starts to become, you know, something that's interesting to you as well. How can we end that? So, you know, there are so many aspects to the fundamentals of Taoism, but I would say one of the big ones that really calls to me at this moment is the relief of suffering, you know, not just for myself as an individual or my family, but worldwide. How can we sort of help relieve the suffering in the world? As a kid, so my father was interested in Buddhism, and I grew up as a martial arts kid. And so I had a lot of exposure to Asian culture. My father started teaching me meditation when I was a young teenager, as well as my martial arts teacher. And so I got really interested in, you know, in meditation, maybe for the mindfulness and the relaxation part that a lot of people care about now, but as a teenager, probably more in like the superpowers. My younger sister gave me a copy of the Tao Te Ching, I think for my 13th birthday. I read that book and I was really fascinated with just the cryptic language in it, because it seemed to be espousing answers for just about anything you could come up with. And that was really the launching point. And, you know, because I was involved in martial arts and I had all these, you know, Asian influences in my life, you know, it never really separated from me. And I kind of just stayed with it through my teens and into college, where I studied Taoism and I studied Chinese medicine and Chinese and Japanese language, and, you know, ended up living in China. And, you know, it had this momentum that I can't even explain.
That's amazing. Are there certain practices that have stuck with you?
Every day is an interesting question, because I tend to live sort of cyclically, in that I see I see practices as like medicine, in that, you know, there are certain medicines that you take a lot, and there are certain medicines that you only use when you need them. And so one of the big ones is meditation. How much I use meditation definitely varies. You know, I mean, there are time periods in my life where I'll meditate a lot and really in deep and multiple times a day. And then there are periods where it'll draw back and it'll be shorter sessions and less focused. And, you know, and so then all the other practices that we do, including visualization meditations or ritual practices, you know, self-inquiry, those are all things that I do very regularly, but they depend on, again, my particular needs or situations at the time. You know, what my life is like, you know, what my clinic patients are like, how much traveling I'm doing to, you know, back and forth to China, or, you know, how much teaching I'm doing, those kinds of things. But I tend to really think of this stuff as medicine. So we use it more when we need it more, less when we need it less. But some of it are things we take every day, no matter what.
Have you ever had any experiences with these practices?
Yeah, you know, there's a couple of aspects we can get into. It definitely, it's almost embarrassing to talk about these things sometimes because they seem so woo-woo. The first one I ever had, you know, I was about 16, and I was doing really getting serious about this particular meditation that I had learned from one of my teachers at the time. And I was doing it every night, and I would do it for about an hour-ish, you know, depending on, I mean, I was a teenager, so I don't, you know, sometimes that didn't happen as much. But I was really focused on it, and, you know, I was really focused on the benefits that would come out of that, and I was really interested in them, looking for them. And so I was on a good stretch of, I was hit right around 100 days at this point. And I remember I went and I finished the meditation, and I laid down on my bed, and I had this experience where I started to hear this very loud noise in my ears, almost like a rumbling, you know, like the sound that thunder makes, but it was constant. And I could feel my arms and legs sort of raising up off of the bed. And I was like, wow, this is really strange. And then I could start to see, you know, this, what seemed like energies or spirits or beings, or I don't really know what to call them at this point in my life, around in the room, you know, and I just could sense the presence of all these things all and around me as I was sort of floating up. And then I kind of realized what was happening, and I like snapped myself out of it, and I kind of plopped back down on the bed, and I was like, what the heck just happened to me? That was really crazy. Really, I called my dad, and I asked my dad, what was this about? And, you know, his advice was really, don't worry about it. Don't chase it. These kinds of things happen. Just don't focus on it. Just go relax and lay down. And my other teachers sort of confirmed the same thing. You know, like in sort of Taoist lingo, we talk about these two aspects of the human. Is one is our pre-heaven side, which is our true innate nature. You know, people might call it like our Buddha nature or something like that. And then we also talk about what we call post-heaven side, which is the illusory body and the illusory mind. And we spend so much time in the illusion of the stories that we create about our current existence. And that when we start to glimpse those moments, like, you know, through like a transcendental experience like you're talking about, or a vision of what we consider to be pre-heaven in Taoism, sometimes that is almost uncomfortable at first and a little scary, because it's like, wait a minute, that's just an illusion, and this is the real thing? Well, this is strange, and it's a little frightening at first. And I think the more you can touch it, the more you see the illusion is just illusion, and the more you see the other thing is your true you. And it becomes less scary, and you really want to be there more. And that's what we consider to be more like realization experiences and whatnot.
Everything that we're ingrained in the beginning of our lives about how society is and how it should be, I felt like more and more of that crumbled.
Yeah, I agree. I had the same experience with it, where the my attachment to what I thought was real or what appeared to be real to me just kind of gets less and less important. And pretty soon you start to see it as if you're watching a show on TV, then you know it's not real. You know it's not something you want to even be necessarily involved in that way. You know, we call it relinquishing entanglements. So, you know, when we, this idea then of the illusory body and the illusory mind. So when we look at it, like when you look at yourself, like I see myself on the video screen, I know that this person that I see is just the vessel for me in this lifetime, and that my true me is just riding this vessel this time around, and it'll be in a different vessel next time around until I finally can have a enlightenment experience to the point where I can stop samsara. Taoists and Buddhists are pretty much aligned in this idea. And so all of the things then that, you know, I'm engaged in, like my race or my gender or the country I was born in or the job I have or all of these things, they're not really the real me. You know, the real me, I could say, is like a shining golden light, you know, that's an emanation of the Tao. And all of us are an emanation of the Tao. There's non-duality. So we all are basically these shining golden lights that are emanated from the Tao, irregardless of what we look like in the meat suit, you know? And so, but the meat suit is involved in all the entanglements, you know, these, my job, the fights I have with people, the frustrations with traffic, the parent, whatever roles I take on, parent, doctor, you know, podcast host. I mean, all the those roles and then all of the things that those roles are then entangled in, you know, so the you know, the being a parent and then being entangled with the kid and their parent, their friend's parents, and, you know, school, and all of those are just random entanglements, and they're places where, like, passion and aggression and all of these, you know, emotions tend to express themselves. And that's one aspect of the entanglement. Another aspect of the entanglement really is like how desire manifests itself also for this illusory world. Because when we have this funny meeting of the place where our senses meet with desire and the object of desire, and those start to create reality, like, I really want that car, something about that car, it looks really cool, and it pushes some buttons in me, and it makes me feel really good, and all of those, but that's all just illusion, you know, it's not really true bliss. And so finding ways to deal with our entanglements, those things that aren't real, and most often that's sense, desire, and object of desire, where they meet.
So do you practice any non-duality teachings that are associated with Taoism?
Yeah, we do. That's actually a really big part of our particular sect. I'm a 22nd generation Chan Lungmen priest. And so that means complete reality, Dragon Gate. And in complete reality, the main focus on that is working towards non-duality. So we see that the interesting thing is the way we define the Tao is ultimately completely void. It's this complete emptiness, and empty of all things, because it's completely non-dual, yet it's the has the ability to generate all things. And so a lot of our practices really work towards some sort of experience of that, of the Tao, which would be non-duality. And one of the ways we kind of try and experience it is through the experience of spontaneous basic goodness, you know, because we like to think of the Tao as being like cosmic goodness, like this, you know, pure benevolence that is completely void yet able to create things. And so many of our scriptural texts really work around non-duality and emptiness. We talk about things, the things that we think that are things are still empty, and there's still emptiness beyond that emptiness, much like the Heart Sutra talks about. We have actually parallel texts to the Heart Sutra. One we call the the Qing Jing Jing, which is the treatise on stillness and clarity, is really parallel to the Heart Sutra in that regard. And also a text we call the Hu Ming Jing, which is actually has some almost exact similar lines. But we really talk about, you know, the experience of emptiness, knowing full well that there's emptiness beyond emptiness, and that, or formlessness beyond formlessness. Because knowing that, you know, when we think we're experiencing it, there's still something past that. There's still something more non-dual, because as soon as we experience it, we start defining it as a person, and that creates duality. You know, martial arts has been a part of my life since I was 6 years old. And, you know, I've done various styles of it and taught various styles of it, you know, since I was a guy in my 20s, I started teaching, I think, and still training. And I've trained with, you know, people from Japan and Okinawa and Brazil. And I've also, you know, spent a lot of time training in China. And, you know, it's something that my relationship with has changed a lot through the years. I think when I was younger, you know, my parents put me in it just to give me something to do and to channel my little kid energy. And then it really became like a competitive thing for me in my teens and 20s, where it was like a sports outlet, you know? Mm-hmm. And, you know, from my 30s on, my relationship really started to change with it as I was getting deeper and deeper into studying Taoism and Buddhism, in that really trying to understand the relationship that training martial arts had with violence and how that was affecting me as a person, you know, in negative or positive ways. And that's really been an exploration for, you know, 20 years, what that's like. And so, you know, I don't think about it much in terms of, and I haven't for a long time, the need for physical self-protection. You know, we don't really live in that world where that's a massive necessity. Obviously, taking care of yourself is important, but I don't think it should be the focus of your day every day, that you spend hours thinking about, what am I going to do if somebody tries to mug me? I don't think that's good for our mind. You know, it's really become a thing for me now. I like the outlet for it. You know, I like the way it makes my body feel to do those kind of movements. I'm bored to go to the gym. I'm bored to run. But, you know, practicing forms and, you know, all those things they're fun and they're creative and they're interesting to me.
It's more of a creative art of expression, you would say.
Yeah. Yeah. One of my friends, we're about the same age. He calls it masculine dance. You know, it's like martial arts is like masculine dance or something, you know.
Yeah.
I get what he means by that. Because we're spending a lot of time moving our bodies in creative ways. And if you're not really, you know, beating people up or something like that, then that's really what you're doing, is just moving your body in creative ways. And, you know, I had this teacher in China who, he beat cancer twice. And he used to say, he's like, you know, you want to live as good as you can and then drop dead.
Right.
You know, he was amazingly, the month before he died, I remember I was visiting him and he was just like, squeeze my arm. He's like, you know, and he was in his 80s. He's like, I'm not going anywhere soon. You know, and he was really like strong and flexible and, you know, really sharp. And I think, okay, so that's how the training became for him, is those are the things that he did for him. And that's actually what I'm more interested in now, is how can I be, you know, get to be an old man and flexible enough to go from sitting on the floor to standing up without my hands, you know, or keep my wits about me, or, you know, that kind of stuff.
Right. And if anybody did decide to jump you on the street.
I don't know about that. Maybe.
That's awesome. So do you ever find, you practice mindfulness. How does mindfulness integrate with martial arts?
That's interesting. You know, so I personally define mindfulness a specific way. And I think that, you know, the term is used a lot by different teachers in different ways. And so I'm cautious to talk about it generically. So I'm going to say, when I talk about mindfulness, I mean it a certain way. And in that is that, to me, mindfulness is the ability to keep your mind on one topic, and whatever that topic is, for the duration of the time that you're choosing to do that. So if I were meditating, I would see mindfulness as, can I sit here and just consider my breath and pay attention to my breath for 10 minutes without any other birds flying into my brain, you know? And so martial arts, I think, is a great way to practice that, because it gives your mind something to do while you're doing it, whether it's, you know, doing a form or punching a punching bag, or whether it's, you know, sparring or something, because you, as soon as your mind goes somewhere else, then that distraction, you pay for it, you know, and you make a mistake in the form, or somebody chokes you or something, you know. And so I think in that regard, it's really good at martial arts, then, is really good at helping you stay focused on one thing. You know, I like it like that. It's definitely, I do feel like it's a training wheels approach to mindfulness, though, because it's the keeping you focused on doing something is so gross. Like, I'm doing big movements and all that it's really easy to stay focused on. And doing mindfulness where you're just sitting and thinking about your breathing, that's much easier to get distracted on. So I think that I consider martial arts as like beginning mindfulness. And I think a lot of people probably disagree with me on that, but that's my opinion about it. Like a lot of things, the more you do it, the easier it gets. And as your body starts to remember how to do things, you can start to think about other things and it can become distracting. And so I think it's way harder to sit and just think about your breathing and not let other things float in your mind than it is to be waving your arms around, because there's so much more to put your mind on. At least that's my experience with it. I think there are probably people who have different experiences. But
you also practice Chinese medicine, correct?
Yeah, so I have a Chinese medicine clinic in Boulder, Colorado, and I've had this clinic for about 25 years. Interestingly, you know, Chinese medicine for me was not necessarily my first choice of professions. I love it. I'm glad I do it. But I kind of fell into it as a way of trying to explore my other loves of Asian culture, including, like, you know, Taoism and Buddhism and martial arts and whatnot. My relationship with it really changed within a couple of years of starting to study it, where I fell deeply in love with it. And I really saw it as a vehicle of helping people, you know. And so, you know, one of my teachers, my early martial arts teachers, the one who really kind of pushed me in this direction, used to say, he's like, you know, you can spend a lot of time learning to hurt people in martial arts. You need to learn to help people too. And he would talk about his experience learning, and they would do their martial arts training and would do medical training after that, where they would learn, you know, massage or bone setting or herbs or whatnot from their teacher. And he's like, you have to balance yourself out. You can't just be one way or the other. And he's like, this will behoove you to study this. And I was like, okay, this sounds great. Let's you know, explore it more. I like the idea of being a doctor. I wasn't really necessarily in love with a particular type of medicine, but I'd had a lot of Chinese medicine growing up and I was really comfortable with it. And right before I went to school, I'd been applying to, you know, Western medicine school and osteopathic school and Cairo school and Chinese medicine school. I didn't know what I wanted to study. I just knew I would do one. And then I had a really bad knee injury training. And I went to a surgeon, and the surgeon was not the most friendly person in the world. And being an impetuous 20-something, I was like, you know, you're not going to touch me. I'll just do this naturally. I knew I wouldn't die from a knee injury. So I just did, you know, a bunch of Chinese herbs and exercises and acupuncture. And I never had to have surgery, and my knee healed great. And I really kind of fell in love with this idea of, wow, I can do this. You know, I can help people without having to have surgery. And it seemed really magical, you know. And it was really in alignment with all my, you know, years of studying traditional sort of Chinese natural sciences and martial arts and stuff. And I wouldn't change it for the world. I mean, I'm definitely glad I went that way. And otherwise I wouldn't still be doing it. Our perspective on the human body and diseases is that everything has a definable cause. And because of that, the cause always needs to be addressed, not just the symptom. So that's a place where Western medicine, I think, a lot of times just doesn't care. They do look for causes for a lot of things, but a lot of things they also just don't care. So, you know, like, for example, I've never met a person who had a headache from an aspirin deficiency. So the aspirin will treat the symptom of the headache, and there's nothing wrong with treating the symptom. And maybe in a one-off scenario, you don't really need to know why you have a headache. But as a Chinese medicine practitioner, we're always concerned about the why. And the why always has to be addressed. So for the headache, we would not just treat the symptom, because I mean, killing the pain has to happen. We also try and figure, well, why did you get this headache? What's the underlying cause? Was this something to do with your digestive system or hormones or the weather or a muscle strain or stress? And then we want to address that too. Because from our point of view, one cause, one imbalance can lead to a lot of problems. So that imbalance that's maybe causing the headache now might cause something else later, and then might cause something else later. And so that's like a bicycle wheel where the cause is the hub in the wheel and the spokes are the symptoms. And maybe this spoke is screaming at you more now, but this one over here is going to scream at you tomorrow, and this one the next day, and this one the next day. And if we're just chasing the symptoms, you take aspirin for this, and then you take another drug for that, and you know, you never really are getting to the root of the problem, which is the middle, the hub. And so that's a big thing for us. And then what we do is then we just choose the right tools for that. So sometimes it's dietary therapy, sometimes it's herbal medicine, sometimes it's massage or Chinese chiropractic, or sometimes it's acupuncture or cupping or gua sha. You know, there's any number of tools, but whatever it's going to take to lead that hub back into balance, you know. We can also have one symptom can have a whole bunch of different causes. I can think of 10 different reasons people get headaches. And the headache itself may feel the same to somebody, but the reason somebody has it and the reason somebody else have it can be so polarly different that if this person takes the herbs, it might help them, and this person takes those same herbs, it might make it worse. And so we're always really cautious about that, because we look at herbalism as so individual that every single person, you and your whole family, say caught a cold from each other, probably all of your formulas would be a little bit different, because you know, you look at you, all your different ages and genders and body constitutions and all those things. So we try and take that into consideration when we prescribe herbs. And that is why sometimes an herb that seems so ridiculously simple can make you feel better. Like, for example, if somebody's just at the very beginning of catching a cold, and they have that, like, feel just a little bit, tiny bit feverish and chilled, and they're just a little clammy, and they're like, I think I'm catching a cold, and you give them, like, porridge or oatmeal or something with a whole bunch of cinnamon on it, and then you bundle them up and they start sweating, that will usually like kick the cold out. That something so simple as cinnamon can do that, you know, but it has to be the right picture. So if somebody already has like a big giant fever, it won't help. If you catch it just right in the right way, something so simple can make a huge difference. Simple things like cinnamon or mint or ginger can be really profound.
I found that actually turmeric helps me with headaches if I have it.
Yeah, we consider turmeric a circulatory promoter. Like it helps your blood flow. And so we put it in a lot of like pain formulas and injury formulas and things like that. And you know, as modern sort of research on it as an anti-inflammatory, that makes complete sense. It's powerful. It's really powerful.
Have you found certain approaches in Chinese medicine have been more beneficial than practices that, you know, a westernized medical doctor would have?
One big tool that Chinese medicine really outshines Western medicine on is dietary therapy. You know, when we look at an illness, we consider herbs and foods to be the same thing. Like maybe an herb is like a really concentrated form of a food. Like the energetic principles and signatures contained within the herb are just stronger than foods. Like there are things we use medicinally that you just wouldn't eat, you know, but there's some that we would. And so we look at it then, if you shape somebody's diet the same way you would shape their herbal formula, then you can have, it's like every time they eat, they're getting treatment. So that actually can be really cool. So instead of thinking about like somebody's macronutrients and all their vitamins, which is important, you know, don't get me wrong, we're also thinking about, are they getting enough of, you know, certain kinds of energetics in their food, or too much of certain energetics? And that can make a big difference in their health, because then it's like they're taking medicine with every meal, you know. And then the other thing we tend to think about too is we look at how people digest their food. And so if the digestive system is working really, really well, then they're also going to have more benefit out of what they eat, because they're breaking things down completely, and it's making more and more energy and more of them and all the things that they need to stay healthy, and less waste product. And so we tend to also not just shape the kinds of foods we tell people to eat, but how they eat, how often they eat, and how much they eat. And those become really important too. And I have lots of medical doctors as patients, and that none of them really know much more about their diet than the average like person who reads Prevention Magazine or something, you know.
Have you found that, for instance, if somebody comes in with a muscle injury or anything like that, how has acupuncture helped in those areas?
I think acupuncture for orthopedic problems is really powerful. You know, I mean, it's powerful enough that, you know, people have started doing what's called dry needling, which 20 years ago we used to call orthopedic acupuncture. But there's different reasons they use this dry needling term. But, you know, it's so good for pain issues. And that's honestly, I would say that's the number one reason people probably come in most of the time, because they've got this pain or that pain, you know, and it's really pretty powerful at helping your body's sort of own pain relieving abilities increase or work better, but also treating the root of the local area, maybe decreasing inflammation or relaxing muscles or producing more blood flow into an area. Sometimes it treats pain in a way that we don't even know why it works that way, but it does.
Yeah, that's really incredible, because I've had an experience where I went into acupuncture and I felt as if they put the needle, I think it was in my back, and I felt as though the muscle was spasming.
Yeah.
Do you know the science behind that?
I mean, basically what's happening is when a muscle is really tight like that, most times what's happening is, if you think about a muscle as a whole bunch of fibers, and you'll get a few of the fibers that are stuck in the on position. And so they're making a knot. So when you rub somebody's shoulders and you feel those knots, those are places where muscle fibers are stuck on and they're not relaxing. And they're kind of pulling everything into there. And then you get kind of some connective tissue binding up around that as well. And then you start to get poor blood flow. And so it just gets harder and stiffer because the blood flow is so bad. So nobody quite understands this. There's a lot of research around how this works, and they're not quite there yet. But if you take a needle and you slip it in there, cross fiber like that, and you find those fibers that are stuck in the on position, and you tap on them with the needle a few times, they react by like resetting. And when they reset, they'll twitch really hard like that. And when they twitch, then they kind of lengthen back out to normal. And sometimes they'll tighten back up again, and so you have to do it a few times. But that's probably what you experienced, was that tension in those fibers just trying to release. And it'll do that really sudden twitch. It feels really weird.
It does.
But that's one of the signs that something good is happening.
Is there any specific practice that you've ingrained from another country that has really sat with you, that you found was very effective in your practice?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, because I've spent so much time in China, most of what I think about is China. There are a few things I get from Japan, and you know, and I get a couple things from Thailand that I really like, but the majority of things I use are from China. And, you know, I'm here in my clinic right now, and I have a whole pharmacy in here, herbs that we get from China. Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I self-prescribe herbs quite a bit because I've got the pharmacy. So I almost never get sick. You know, anytime there's something that's going on, I just get in the habit of self-prescribing an herbal formula and then modifying my diet. Those are the two things I do the most. And I got into that habit because of one of my mentors in China. So he would modify his diet on a really regular basis. Basically, he would say, I feel this way today, so I'm going to eat more of this and less of that. Or today I'll fast a little bit or something, you know, and then take a small formula, like one or two herbs or something one time a day. And then the next day it might be something else. It's not really in a weird hypochondriac sort of way. It's more like, you know, when you're driving down the highway and you're holding the steering wheel and you're always just doing like these little adjustments. It's like that. You're just keeping the car on the road. So if I feel like today I wake up and I feel my stomach feels a little off, I'll try and figure out what's going on. And I may take a couple of things and eat a little less of something. Or if I'm a little tired, I might use something else and eat something else. And, you know, the other thing that I then add into that is how I modify my exercise. So maybe today I'll maybe work out a little harder or do a little more, you know, stretching and a little less aggressive exercise or something like that. And so I really like to think of all of that, like I mentioned at the very beginning, you know, thinking of practices like medicine. I think of, you know, all aspects of life can sort of affect you in that way. Exercise is medicine, meditation is medicine, herbs are medicine, diet's medicine, food is medicine. And so you just understand what you need and you're always twisting and tweaking it just a little bit. And there are, I do courses with this with my patients sometimes where I try and teach them, you know, kind of basically like, this is your main group of imbalances. This is how you can understand them for yourself. These are foods that are good for these imbalances and bad for these imbalances. These are like exercises that are good and bad. And then you sort of teach them to have a very mindful approach to their own health and then empower them with the knowledge. And so then they don't need me as much to be like constantly helping them with that. They can do more on their own.
Yeah. So it's really just by a case-by-case basis.
Yeah. Like the way I do that is, you know, when I teach those kind of classes, like I do those online because they're pretty easy for people to start with. And we kind of go through all the things to look for. And then you just teach them how to do it. And you give them lists of foods and stuff. And it's not very hard, but everybody is so different. I mean, the two of us probably have really different physical needs. And as a clinician, I figured that out a few ways. One is that, I do pretty extensive questioning. So, you know, where is the headache? What's it feel like? You know, what makes it feel better or worse? Like all of those things help me paint a picture of somebody. And then we used other diagnostics, like we used pulse diagnosis and we look at people's tongues and we kind of feel their neck and head and, you know, try and figure out what's going on there. And then when I can paint an accurate picture, Chinese natural sciences is really straightforward. So if something is stuck, you make it move. If it's too cold, you make it warm. If it's too warm, you cool it down. Like it's very straightforward. So we just create a story. You know, if somebody's getting a tension headache because they're really stressed out, most of the times the story you can kind of create then is the stress is causing muscle tension. The muscle tension is then pulling on their head, and those sort of pathways go up over their head, and that's why they're getting the headache. So you need to deal with the muscle tension, and then you need to deal with the stress, you know. And so we can deal with those in multiple ways, herbs, acupuncture, diet, you know, whatnot. Herbs that we would use in that scenario would probably have like a muscle relaxing effect to them and a circulation promoting effect. So if the person isn't too hot constitutionally, like you mentioned turmeric with black pepper can help calm that down. You know, things that are accessible to your average person, you know, that's a big one that can help relax the muscles and kill pain in that regard. There are lots of different ones. Some of them are really only accessible to herbalists. You can buy over the counter, but even just taking like a topical muscle balm, and rubbing it on the shoulders and the back of the neck will relax the muscles and promote blood flow, and that can usually kill the headache. The things that I've seen work really well for people, I would say the turmeric and black pepper taken with a fat like fish oil, that actually is a pretty good painkiller. Because the research around turmeric is that if you take a little bit of black pepper with it, it makes it work hugely better. So you don't have to take as much turmeric, because a lot of people can't tolerate a lot of turmeric. It can give them stomach stuff, especially Westerners, you know. So you take turmeric with a little black pepper, and then you need a fat to potentiate it. So like, you know, in Indian culture, you guys use a lot of dairy with the turmeric. So there's all the fat in the dairy, which is helps you, you know, absorb it. And you can use dairy, but also just you can use fish oil too. And one of the reasons I like fish oil is it also helps almost like thin the blood in a way. And that can also kill pain. People who take fish oil regularly tend to have less chronic pain. So I like it like that.
Is there like a drink on the top of your head that you would make? Because I know in Indian culture, it would make like a turmeric milk to relieve any type of symptoms that we're having.
Yeah, I mean, that would be the first one I would think of. It's pretty accessible and easy for people.
It is.
And so like, I think making it with either dairy or coconut milk, depending on if you can tolerate dairy. I actually, I like to make it with, I use turmeric and pepper, and then I use evaporated milk or condensed milk. My kid, if I want to give it to him, I'll make it in condensed milk because it's so sweet and he'll take it that way.
Do you have anything for nausea?
Yeah, the two probably biggest go-tos most of the time and the safest go-tos are mint and ginger. When we use ginger, though, we always use raw ginger for that. Dry ginger is actually sometimes a little too spicy, a little too warm. We usually will use raw ginger. So you take a knob of it, maybe about an inch, and you grate it into a mug and then pour boiling water on it. And then when it cools off enough that you can drink it, you just drink that tea. And that works really well for nausea. People who don't like that spiciness, we also use mint as well. Those are the two biggest easy go-tos.
Is there anything particular that you found with one of your clients that has been very effective, just depending on what they had?
In the last few years with the virus of unnamed origin that we dealt with, I was really amazed at how well some really simple herbal formulas helped with that. You know, I think when we got past the fear of what that was and just treated it like you would, you know, colds and flus, it actually responded really well, and it responded really well to pretty mild treatments. I've had to use way more aggressive things for the flu than I did for that. I think, you know, sometimes there's a tendency to feel like we need to use like bigger and stronger and more powerful and, you know, what would be considered like a more complicated and whatever else formulas for things. But a lot of times you can get away with super, super simple things. Like I mentioned, the ginger in the person who's the cinnamon when somebody's just barely catching a cold. Like, really simple things can sometimes be all you need. You just need to just put the right push on something. If it's too simple, it's not going to work, you know? We need something that's more high-tech or more science-y or something, you know? We live in a time when the religion of the West is science. Whenever you talk to people about something, they'll always... Well, you know, research said, a study said, maybe if you say, well, my friend had this and did that and it worked great for them, they might be like, But then if you said, the study said, then they're like, oh, really? Like, it's the religion of, and right now. And the tendency then is to make things really complicated. But I think getting back to like grandma remedies and stuff, there's a lot of wisdom in old things. And science doesn't know everything. We can't understand everything, so that doesn't make it not effective. Here's an example. Like in 2000, I was doing a stint at this university hospital in Nanjing, and there was a doctor there who had a formula that he used to induce labor, and it was really effective. He would put together a bunch of raw herbs, and they would cook it and give it to the woman to drink to get labor started. And it worked so well. The hospital was like, well, we want to make this into a pill and be able to just sell it and, you know, make it really easily, but we need to do some studies on it to isolate it down. And so they were doing rabbit studies, and they were, you know, making this stuff and doing injections, and they could never get it to work on these rabbits. So they just gave up on it. That it just was a fluke. You know, they kind of neglected the fact that it was created by a human for a human who was pregnant at a certain point in time. It wasn't made for a rabbit who's being cut open. And, you know, it all, like, we have to remember these things have a certain thing that make them work, and we may not be able to understand them in that regard.
I really enjoyed you coming on and sharing your insights and your wisdom. Where can we find you?
Yeah, so for the Chinese medicine side of my reality, you can find me at mountainwestwellness.com. That's the website for my clinic. And, you know, my clinic, we do inpatient visits. We also do virtual visits. So I have patients all over the world that I work with virtually. And then as far as Taoism goes, you know, Taoism, I run an organization called Parting Clouds Taoist Education with my Taoist brother, Josh Painter. We founded this organization together as a way to share Taoist education with Westerners. And we have people all over the world that are students of ours. We just came back from China doing a visit to on a big pilgrimage to the birth site of Lao Tzu, and a meeting with the World Federation of Taoists, which is an organization for foreign Taoists that's sponsored by the Chinese Taoist Association in China. And so we run this organization called Parting Clouds Taoist Education, and you could find us there at partingcloudstaoisteducation.com as well. And we do virtual teaching there. So,
well, thank you, Jack, so much for coming on the show. It's been incredible. I've learned so much.
Thanks for having me.